I'm Bob. I am a most of the time grateful member of ACA.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, everybody. I'll explain that in just a minute. When George said something about me being fabulous, I checked in with my body to see how that resonated, because the first time I heard that after I'd got into recovery and somebody made me a compliment like that, I burst into tears and I cried for 15 minutes. And I had no idea how deep the disease had affected me at that point. And I'm really, really glad that not only did I find you, but that I've stuck with you. And before I go any further, I want to say thank you, Kelly. That was magnificent. Really, really good share. I got a lot out of it, and I shared with her during the break that it filled my mind up with all sorts of things, so I sort of had extemporaneous yet point-by-point things to share about. Now I'm all over the map, so we'll see what happens. I never know how to address my coming to you date, and because I'm in a number of other 12-step programs, and people count on me staying in them. I count on me staying in them. I guess I can't say that it's a born-on date, because I think that's a Coors commercial. That's sure not appropriate. And a born-again date kind of has religious connotations, so I guess that's not too good either. So I'll just say that I came to you on May the 17th, 1989. In the Sunnyvale, California Tuesday night ACA meeting. And I sat down in that meeting, and a fellow came to share that night his story, and I heard my story. And I cried all through that meeting too. Just felt feelings, grumblings inside, different kinds of things that were not normal for me. Some of you may have heard Dr. Stephanie Brown at last year's ACA event down in Rancho Palos Verdes. I see some nodding of heads. Stephanie is a friend of mine. If I'm name dropping tonight, this is not in any way to impress you. It is to say that part of my journey in ACA has been to pay attention to people who have gained elements of respect and are respectful, and I learn a lot from them, and I need every piece of information I can get. And I heard Stephanie for the first time around 1990, and she was doing a talk about how recovery works at Sequoia Hospital in Redwood City. And while she was at the podium, she said, "For us to recover, we have to become abnormal." And I remember shivering, because after I got to you and began to work the program, I found out how much shame I carried coming in here. Now, I thought shame only applied to women. Not so. And a lot of guys that I work with carry huge amounts of shame into these rooms, and to get to that at a feeling level is something that I still aspire to do. Callie mentioned watch out what you pray for. She didn't use exactly those words, but really that's what propelled me into my ACA process. So I'm going to share a little bit of my story, and then I'll share as much about recovery as I can, and George, wave me down when I've got 5 minutes or so, so I can hopefully wrap up. I've got so much to share. The next thing that I want to say is I am so grateful to be in a room among heroes. You are all my heroes. Coming into this program is not easy. We hear that in the words that are shared. And part of the reason that it's not easy is that everything in one way or another that was modeled for me was modeled for you was normal. That's what we were used to. It was normal for us to be unhealthy or to live unhealthy. And Stephanie said, in order to recover, you have to become abnormal. So I needed to begin to think about what that actually meant. And the way that I have become abnormal in every program that I have worked the 12 steps in means that I shift the way that I was doing things into the possibility of doing them differently. And when I do them differently, different gets better. Some of you may know Father Tom W. from up in Oakland. If you hear his tapes or you've ever heard him in person, he often will share that coming into recovery means first it gets better, then it gets worse, then it gets real, then it gets different, then it gets real different. That's the description of the ACA journey. So, after my first meeting, I looked up both in the Al-Anon directory. One of my sponsors told me, had the unmitigated gall to tell me I needed to go to 100,000 Al-Anon meetings. No idea why I would say that. Yes, I do. And so I chose, because I'd heard my story in an ACA meeting, to, in Santa Clara County, there's a booklet that's got, it's a meeting directory. I'm sure that we have something similar to it in the five city San Luis Obispo County area. Other areas have quite extensive booklets. This one was detailed out, so the Al-Anon meetings that had ACA focus were actually in the book described that way. And so I went to those meetings. And on a Sunday evening, not long after I came to you, I was looking at this guy in the meeting, and it took me a few moments to recognize him. Kurt R., who now resides in Auburn. And I had plotted ways I was going to undermine this guy's life. I did not like him. And I didn't like him because we were both competitive athletes, and I competed against him quite often. And the only way that I could survive in this world in any way that made sense to me was by using substances or thought processes or competing in sports. Other than that, I didn't have anything that computed into healthy behavior patterns. They were not mentored in my family of origin. Not mentored. So I knew nothing about him except that every time that he'd do well when he was competing against us, it made me mad. And so that night, when he shared in that meeting, I cried. And I paid attention to him like you taught me to do. And when you hear one story, and in that process that we go through to develop trust, so tiny for some of us in the beginning, but just the opening of that crack is so important. I thought, I wonder if I can have a conversation with this guy, because what he was saying in recovery was overriding this nastiness that I felt inside of me toward him. I didn't even know him. But that was part of what was modeled in my family of origin also. So it was normal for me to think and feel that way. And he became my sponsor. And when I sat down with him, we had a similar experience that Callie was describing. We'd meet every week. I'd call him often. And we'd sit in a Hobie's restaurant and talk to each other about real things. Stuff that was going on, not just in the program, but stuff that was sensitive to the world at large. And part of the 12-step essence is, as I get stronger inside, I want to do things that will make a difference to my fellows in recovery, but also a difference to people in the world. Annie L., who is a popular author and a friend of ours, says, and this is perfect for this environment and those of us that may have a problem with a God concept, that we all come into church. It's the church of me too. And I love that. Because when I come in here, I can relate to you. And Kurt became a model for me because I could relate to things that he was saying. And eventually, I talked to him about the animosity that I'd felt toward him. And it deepened our relationship. Because intimacy is something that I have learned that we crave from the time that we come out of the womb. Some of you may remember Bob Earle. He describes it like this. When we're born, our insides and outsides match perfectly. And then dysfunctionality in our homes and in our society, our culture, begin to create this distancing between our insides and our outsides. Our feelings and our realities don't match. And coming into recovery means that we're moving more toward that level of coming back to that perfect communion of our insides and outsides. So my first journey in was AA and NA. And I would come into an Alano club and I would sit down in my first 60 days or so, and there was a matriarch in the Alano club, Marge D. And Marge would run the kitchen during lunchtime, and lunches were provided. And the Alano Club was a container for 28 meetings. It was a large fellowship. Duncan talked about intergroup. The business meetings for that fellowship were something else. I mean, it was just like fur flying all over the place, which turned out to be really important. I'll get to a little bit of that in a moment. Marge would sit down with me, and she was absolutely brilliant at just planting little seeds to get people to talk. And I'd sit there and I'd bawl, oh, just empty things. And then I'd cry. And after a couple of months of sitting there, something touched me, and I was crying harder than I usually did. And Marge looked at me and she said, "Bob, I'd really like to know what happened to you." And I sat straight up and I thought, I'd really like to know what happened to me. And that, coupled with the fact that I finally, at 14 months in the AA program, got through my first four step, partly because I started writing it at 3 months. I got through 1, 2, and 3 quite quickly. But I felt so much shame, and as things would come down on the paper, I was afraid to look at them. I didn't want to. I mean, that's the reason that I escaped reality in the first place. And through therapy, which I advocate so much, both personally and in our coupleship, I got to know that perhaps, no, for sure, my alcohol and drug use probably prevented me from becoming a teen suicide, because I could not add one and one together to make two, the way that my family of origin had operated. So I began to build in the ACA program with Kurt very early, and he guided me to do something called Recovery of Your Inner Child, which is a workbook by Dr. Lucia Capocchione, who happens to reside up in Cambria. And she's the therapist who invented the therapy strategy of writing inventories, letters to people, amends letters with your non-dominant hand. I'm right-handed. She invented the practice to write with your non-dominant hand. That's an exercise that can be quite challenging. You just eliminate the fact that your handwriting looks ridiculous, and you have at it. And it's an automatic division of left brain, right brain phenomena, and it will bring feelings up immediately. It's a terrifically useful tool. I recommend you have a working relationship with a sponsor if you decide to do that, because it'll bring up a lot of stuff. And I so wholeheartedly believe in sponsorship. I mean, when I came in, I would disclose everything to all the wrong people and not tell the right people what it was important for them to hear. I couldn't reach out and ask for help, and I still today have trouble with that, which is embarrassing to admit, but it's true. And it's not like it isn't an important piece of my recovery. It's just that over the course of time in recovery, I have made choices that put me in a position of compromise. And then, of course, I want to blame you for it. Because the wounds were deep. And it's a reactive kind of a situation that I'm used to doing. So I have to be abnormal and say, no, I'm not going to do that. What is my piece? Which Kelly was alluding to. So a lot of things were going on with me. Lots and lots and lots of things were going on with my relationship with Kurt. And we got through the steps in Al-Anon and then in ACA in pretty rapid succession, because I had gotten to a lot of the foundational things in my first four step in AA. And I sponsor men in ACA. I have a sponsor, and I always work them through the AA steps before I do the ACA steps. And the reason for that is that it's really hard for some of us to get to our piece of the action, and it's such an important part. Once I can begin to learn what my side of the street is, and it takes a while to get to that, then the rest of the things that come about are easier to bring to the surface for me. Lee, this is, I'm just speaking from my experience, not saying that this is the way anybody has to do anything. So Kurt kept suggesting that I go hear people. So every time anybody was coming to town, a lot of the foundational members of Adult Children of Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of you probably have read Language of Letting Go, Melody Beattie, P.M. Melody's stuff, Raquel Lerner, Patrick Carnes, I could go on and on. If I saw these names, I went to the talks. And then I'd go up and introduce myself, and sometimes I'd be shaking. It took me months to stand up in front of a group of people in a meeting, because I was so terrified that if I shared who I am, that you would not want anything to do with me. So that experience came from not being in a military family. I moved 11 or 12 times by the time I was 12 years of age. So there was no possible way I was going to be able to integrate with anything or anyone. By the time I got to second grade, I was so crazy that I threw the American flag on the floor. I took my pants off in class a couple of times, and there were no consequences. I didn't seek counseling. I even would hear my mother on the phone blaming the school or the teacher for this, because her stuff was shame-based also. And over the course of time, I knew inside my gut that something was seriously wrong. It's interesting to be sharing with you in a church setting, because I was supposed to be the next in a long line of Methodist ministers, and that just flat wasn't going to happen. And it was unfortunate, because my grandfather, who was the father figure that was only there a very small amount of time, because he was traveling all over the world, he was a very well-respected, very spiritual man, and had I had the opportunity to be connected with him, a lot of things could have been different. I did not have that opportunity. Just this morning, I had an epiphany when I woke up, some forgiveness for my mom. I love it when that comes, and it comes in layers, because we did make peace about a week before she passed away in a very profound experience, which I hope I remember to share. But anyway, my experience with my grandfather was that my father figure was made out to be the devil by my mom. He was a womanizer, he was a drunk, he was all different kinds of things. But part of what was going on with that was the protection for her not wanting to admit mistakes and do anything wrong. And I saw my dad five times in my adult life, from the time I was 17 years old until in my 40s. And He had left when I was 4 years old and never come back. My parents were married to each other and divorced twice. So after they were divorced, they got reconnected, remarried, full-on church wedding, and then divorced again. He left. And this is a few-hour story about my dad, so I'll just concise it to say, after I realized from my ACA fourth and fifth steps that I didn't know my father's story, I was in a men's group, and we were challenged to tell our father's story, and I didn't know my father's story. So I called him and told him I wanted to see him. And we got together and had a four-year relationship. And part of the reason that he left was he was abnormal. He was a relatively healthy man, admitted his idiosyncrasies and so on. But most of my personality, the development of who I was, even as an athlete, because I painted faces on men's bodies and wanted not to tackle them, I wanted to hurt them or even get away with murder. I had that kind of rage inside. Made me an effective player at some level, I suppose, but it didn't have anything to do with reality. And then it turns out that my dad's not a bad guy. So I share this part of my journey because I believe that at some level or another, every one of us in this room has got that kind of dysfunction under their belt. And we have to become abnormal to erase that to the point where in 6 and 7, erase is too strong a word. I don't think I've had any of my character defects completely removed. They sure softened, and I'm really grateful for that. But if I am triggered by something and I'm acting out, it's all from stuff in the past. No question about it. No question about it. So the propulsion into greater work in the program happened in 1991. And I heard that there was a conference coming to San Jose called Life Balance. Any of you that have been around for a while remember Life Balance? This was this group of ACAs that had formulated ACA and CODA starting about 35 years ago, maybe a little longer than that, culminating with ACA about 30 years ago. And they were going around giving conferences all over the country. And they'd start on Friday and they would end on Sunday morning. And I made it a point to get to this conference. And Bob Earl kicked it off, and then there were all kinds of speakers, well-known speakers, and it was an ebb and flow kind of experience where a lot of really heavy, detailed information would come out, and then they'd have a fun workshop. And I realized that I had to learn to have fun. I really didn't know how to have fun when I got here, except to go to sporting events, because there was my passion. It was my connection to my own reality. But just to have fun, that was difficult. And the theme of this conference was intimacy, defined as me being me and letting you see me, or into me you see. I like that a lot. And I heard these speakers, and I went home after that conference, and I knelt down behind my bed like I was a four-year-old. And I said, oh God, I want what these people have, and I'm willing to go to any length to get it. Please help me be an intimate man for the rest of my life. 20 minutes or so goes by. The phone rings. Bob, I loaned you $20. You said you were going to pay me back this week. I haven't seen you. You all right? Bob, you're supposed to meet me for coffee on Wednesday. You didn't show up. Are you all right? And I was challenged one thing after another to the point where I went crawling to my sponsor and I said, you know, this is happening, that's happening, I'm not responsible for this. And he said, describe what you've been doing over the course of the last week or two. And I told him about the prayer, and he said, Mal, you've just got an example of watch out what you pray for. And I asked him, could I unpray a little bit of it? And he told me I couldn't do that. So I am an advocate of using the meditation process to ask myself questions a lot of the time. What do I really want? What is it that I want to do? What is it that I want to share with Beth? What is it that we can share together as a couple? Because she has a her and I have a me and we have a we. And we are committed to each other in an intimate relationship. And it took a lot of work for me to get to that position. Lots of therapy, lots of meetings, lots of in-depth work with my sponsor, and now sponsees are starting to trickle in again. I'm working with a guy right now that is telling my story in so many ways, including his business models and his family of origin stuff. So working the entire aspect of the program has got such great strength for me that I would be lost without it. I would really be lost. And I need to keep up a schedule so I can talk about and admit what's really going on with me when times are in struggle. Because the triggers that come back will cause me to want to become normal again, and I don't want to become normal. I want to maintain abnormality. I watched fear run my family. So of course, when I got to you, I was afraid. When I'm vulnerable today, where do I go? I go to fear. And I have to be honest about it. One of the main gifts of ACA also is learning to express anger in a healthy manner. I see spots in front of my eyes when I hear somebody talking in an AA meeting about anger being the dubious distinction of normal men. That's preposterous. Anger is a secondary emotion. I get angry, I feel angry. If I don't learn to express it appropriately, it builds and it creates an image in my mind that says I have a right to be angry. That's not correct. There's no such thing as a right to be angry. I either am or I am not. So Beth and I do a lot of work together, and we also do work individually on healthy expression of anger. I learned that in sponsorship. The first time I see somebody I'm working with, or when I'm working with my sponsor and he looks at me and he says, "Are you angry?" I have a choice. I can say no. But there I would be stuffing. And that's not true. If someone can see that in me, then it's probably going to be there. And it's the same way when I'm working with someone. So then I want to know why I'm angry. And then I can feel safe enough to know why someone else is angry. This is a process. This didn't come to me right straight out of the gate or even after a while in the ACA program. But it's important for me to remember always that this is a journey. This is not destination-oriented 101. It's just not. You know, the things that oftentimes that I have thought served me well, I wind up having to turn over. I don't want them back. And some of the things that I thought were defects have turned out to be real strong assets. And the longer that I walk with you, the better I do. Some of my ACA recovery tools have been, I have gone back to everywhere I lived where the abuse happened, except Warren, Ohio, where I was born. I have been inside my white picket fenced house in Wilmette, Illinois, 5 times. The last time I was there, Beth came with me. And she'd known the story of my being up in the attic and hiding in the walls because there were storage doors, and I'd go back in there and hide and I wouldn't come out because it was a lot better to face the consequences of the physical abuse or the emotional incest with verbal abuse than it was to be for a small modicum of time than it was to have it in my face all the time. So I learned safe places. When I got into therapy, my therapist said, find a safe place, because I was talking about being overwhelmed. And she helped me map that So when I'm feeling overwhelmed, I find that safe place. That was born from going back to that house and facing the fact that I'm not in denial anymore about what happened. The steps brought that up. And I can go back there now and absolutely revel in the notion that the freedom that I've gotten from being a part of you is something that I can cherish, something that I can hold on to. I participate in everything that I can relative to this program. When I know that an event's going on, I try to get to the event. If I'm asked to share, I like to share. Bye, ladies. Have fun.
Thank you.
And I want to learn more. I mean, I was really vulnerable when I got in here, and I'm at my best when I'm really vulnerable, when I'm teachable. And I want to remain teachable. So, how are we doing? We're good? Okay. So part of me would say, I don't know what that means. Are we good? Does that mean I can stop? Or
keep going.
Okay. Well, I'm actually getting pretty close to, I think, being fairly complete. I mean, I'd love to stick around and answer questions if anybody had them about different aspects of recovery. Mostly what I can say is one of my mentors is a couple, Gay and Kathleen Hendricks. I don't know if they're in ACA or not, but they wrote a book called Conscious Loving, which is a delightful read. And they have a prayer in there that I'll share with you, which I believe it's my ACA prayer, and it goes like this. God, I want to see and handle everything I need to be free. And I would like my lessons to come in a kind and gentle way for me and for others around me. I need to talk to you and reason things out. Learn to cooperate. Also, if I have a strong opinion based on something that has guided me through experience, and I see somebody that's going to walk in front of a moving bus, I am not going to call my sponsor and ask if it's okay if I pull them out, metaphorically speaking. I don't know what to do almost all the time. I need to ask for help. But I do believe in structure, and I believe in paying attention to trusted people. So I come in here, and I'm observant, and I try to act like a dry sponge being thrown into a pool of water. And when I find somebody I can trust, I want to talk to them, and I want a relationship with them. And by golly, if they called me up and said, Bob, I think you ought to do this, it's my suggestion, because it's often buffered with that. It's a healthy thing to say. I do take it as if I was listening to a parachute instructor suggesting that I pull a ripcord when I jump out of a plane. Because the information that I got from an unhealthy setup put me into a position, which is the worst position I can be in, and that is to think that I'm immune from being told what to do. I need to be told what to do by the right people. Otherwise, I go to stubbornness. You're not going to tell me what to do. And then I start making decisions that are not always in my better interests. So I try to learn from my mistakes. I try to celebrate those. And if someone comes to me and says, Bob, this is what you're saying, this is what you're doing, which do you want to be true? I might growl at them in my mind, but I'm there to hug them because they're telling me the truth. And I do believe in, I don't know who said it, but to know the truth will set you free. And then when you speak it to others, you can help set them free. And I can honestly say I love you all. I'm so grateful to be asked to come and share anywhere. It gives me a chance to know that I've gone from a position of invisibility and then creating my own invisibility because I didn't want people to see me, the double-edged sword of invisibility, to being able to be seen, to be able to be comfortable in my own skin over 50% of the time, and when I'm not, I let somebody know. and for you and all the work you're doing, whether you've been in for a little while or a long time, it's all good. You're all heroes. And I'm so glad to be a part of you. Thank you.